precisely because Simone de Beauvoir occupied a unique position in relation to the intellectual discourses of her time, she became the greatest feminist theorist of our century. Long before the emergence of the women's movement, the second sex posed every one of the problems feminists today are still working to solve. The book literally changed thousands of women's lives. I can think of no other work of similar effects in the 20th century.
It was the interviews Christina Stead gave late in life that first aroused my curiosity. I'm a good-natured person, she would insist. I don't expect anything because I don't care. I take everything as it comes. The facade she displays is brusque and pragmatic. Her rhetoric is scientific, influenced, she would always say, by her naturalist father. But this detached persona seems scarcely reconcilable with Stead's fiction, repeatedly described by critics as savage and furious. I find myself wondering about the person behind the mask.
Biographer Hazel Rowley and literary critic Toral Moy. They'll be back in just a moment to discuss their books about the Australian novelist Christina Stead and the French critic Simone de Beauvoir. This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond with part four in a series of discussions for Women's History Month. Support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. In their personal lives, as in their art and intellectual accomplishments, the Australian novelist Christina Stead and the French critic Simone de Beauvoir were very different people. Nonetheless, they shared two important characteristics. They were both women, and they both went through daunting personal and artistic struggles in order to invent themselves as writers. Listen now as the authors of two recent biographies focusing on Christina Stead and Simone de Beauvoir talk about their subjects and about the biographer's art. Toral Moy teaches at Duke University, where she serves as professor of literature and romance studies. Hazel Rowley teaches at Deakin University in Australia. Toral Moy is the author of Simone de Beauvoir, The Making of an Intellectual Woman, which was published in 1994. Hazel Rowley's biography of Christina Stead appeared in 1993. For openers, I asked Hazel Rowley to comment on Christina Stead's place in 20th century literature.
She was a left-wing writer and a realist, also inspired by modernism. And I think why she's important today is that she's one of these very exciting writers in the realist tradition who place her characters in their material circumstances. So, for example, I find that she says very interesting things about colonialism, Australia versus England, what it felt like to be a colonial in England in the 1920s. And she says very interesting things about women, the difficulty for women to express or fulfill sexual desire as young unmarried women, and the importance of sexual desire in their lives. She was, I think, in her novel For Love Alone, one of the first writers, certainly I suppose the first writer, to write about the strength of female sexual desire in an unmarried woman. She's, above all, a writer who satirizes, and she's a character writer. And her, since all her friends were communists, or at least on the left, they were the ones she tended to write about. Mm-hmm. But she wrote about their bad faith. She wrote about their capacity for self-deception and hypocrisy, so that you don't pick up a Christina Stead novel and think, oh, right, this is propaganda for the left.
Let me invite Toral Moy into the conversation. Your colleague, you're from Australia. Toral is, my goodness, you're a European here at Duke University. You had a question for Hazel, Toral.
Well, first I should say I'm actually from Norway, which is as far away from Australia as you can get. And then I have read Hazel's biography of Christina Stead with great interest. And the first thing that really struck me about Christina Stead is that she was such a cosmopolitan writer. She lived her childhood and youth in Australia, and then she left and spent she spent the whole of her writing life abroad.
This was what, 30, 40 years almost?
46 years. Uh-huh. Mm.
And so my question is, I mean, what does it mean to a writer to write all her novels in other countries? She lived in England, in France, in America. She writes about those countries. I mean, what are the advantages and what are the drawbacks?
Yes, it's a very important question. Christina Stead left Sydney in 1928 when she was 25. and she didn't go back until she was an old woman of 72 with an international reputation. And in the meantime, she'd become a writer who set her novels in France, Switzerland, New York, the north of England. In fact, I don't know any major writer who could be called more cosmopolitan than Christina Stead. She shared with D.H. Lawrence that capacity to move to another area and to pick up the atmosphere, the idiom, the expression. She was particularly good at speech. I think the thing was that she was one of these writers who was very well known in the 30s and the 40s. She suffered from the fact that her best books were published in the war, so that Americans in particular weren't terribly interested in The Man Who Loved Children when they were worried about whether to enter the war. But it was her post-war novels that caused the problems, and so that she went from being a well-known writer in England and America, and partly in Australia, to not being able to get her novels published. And when the publications, when her books were rejected and increasingly her left-wing friends felt out of place in the Cold War, she took to drinking and generally, certainly suffered a mild but chronic depression for years. And then when her book, The Man Who Loved Children, was reissued in 1965 and she once again became a name, she was even mentioned for possibility of Nobel Prize, shortly after that her husband died. And she felt completely bereft.
Let's turn our conversation, Hazel Rowley and Toral Moy, to the subject of Toral's book on Simone de Beauvoir. Before our taping session, we were talking about these two women, and Toral, you told me that that Simone de Beauvoir is the central feminist intellectual thinker for you in the 20th century. And by contrast, Hazel said that her subject, Christina Stead, was not a feminist. I want you to explain how you arrived at the conclusion that you did, and then we'll come back to Hazel's subject.
I think, Wayne, that what I said and what I really mean is that Simone de Beauvoir is two things. She's the emblematic intellectual woman of the 20th century, and she is also the greatest feminist thinker in this century.
Those are big orders. Those are very, very tall descriptions. How about it?
And they're two different questions. I mean, they are connected, of course, but she is the emblematic intellectual woman in our century for a couple of completely concrete reasons. She belongs to the first generation of European women who get an education on a par with men. That is, she gets to go to university, take the same exams as men. She does this in the 1920s. This kind of university career that's now open to all women had not been open to women of the previous generation.
These are things that we take for granted, or they seem very natural to us.
Indeed, but Simone de Beauvoir had to do that as a pioneer. She was the ninth woman in France to take the specific exam in philosophy that she did.
Did she do it as a pioneer? I mean, do you have the sense that she was deliberately, that she thought of herself as a groundbreaker?
No, this is the difference between me and my perspective on her and her perspective on herself. Simone de Beauvoir is interesting to young women in universities today, I think, because she thought of herself as just a gifted individual. She says in her autobiography, "I'm not a woman, I'm just me." She thought she wasn't being treated as an equal in a meritocratic society and an completely egalitarian educational system that had just opened its doors to women. Mm-hmm. And that is indeed what young women today believe. What I'm showing in my book is that the story is much more complicated than that. Yes, indeed, she could take the same exams, but does she get the same reception among critics? Does she get the same kind of intellectual prestige out of doing as well for the same exams? The answer is no. Mm-hmm. And I think the same thing is happening today as well.
Now, Toro, the subtitle of your book is The Making of an Intellectual Woman. Should I construe that to mean that Simone de Beauvoir is a kind of leader for women in the 1990s? You say that she is emblematic. How far do you take this logic?
Well, I think that, of course, Simone de Beauvoir was born in 1908. She died in 1986, so she belongs to a different generation than, say, women who are studying or are working as intellectuals now. But she belongs to the first generation who lives the kind of lives that we live. That is, she gets an education, she has to make a career in a field where she has to compete with men on equal footing. She has to try, and this is very important, the reason why she's an emblematic intellectual woman is that she has to try to live as an independent woman, and that's what she writes about. That is why she becomes the incarnation of a new type of woman for me.
You said that the word freedom is very important in understanding who Simone was and how she speaks to us today.
Yes, in two ways. Because she tries to incarnate a certain notion of freedom in her own life by becoming an independent woman. I show in my book that that's not easy and that it's not like you can just go out there and be completely free. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, she also writes what I consider the most important feminist book in this century, the book called The Second Sex, published in France in 1949 and in America in 1953. And in The Second Sex, her problematic is freedom. Why are women not able to live and think as they like in their societies? This is a simple way of saying it. Simone de Beauvoir's notion in The Second Sex is that women are treated as other by a patriarchal system. Sexism consists in making women believe that they are objects rather than acting subjects. So that Simone de Beauvoir's problematic is that the oppression of women deprives them of their freedom to act as they choose. That's her line.
Hazel, Rowley?
Well, I'm interested in what Toral says in that I had in no way any temptation to identify with Christina Stead. There was a big distance between me and this woman who in many ways was very difficult. But I sense when Toral speaks that she does identify, that is to say that she's working out some sort of relationship with Beauvoir, which is very important. And I should just add at this point that Toral and I met in Melbourne, Australia, because we both have worked on Simone de Beauvoir, and what we both have in common, surely, is a strong, or has been a strong identification with Simone de Beauvoir.
What about this, Toral? You said that Simone was one of your idols. What was the idol of your youth? Is that right?
Oh, yes. I mean, we have to now go back to when I was 15 and lived in a little mountain village in Norway, and we should distinguish that from now, right? But when I was 15 and lived in this Norwegian mountain village, I discovered Simone de Beauvoir through newspaper reports. I read an abbreviated Norwegian translation of The Second Sex, and I got this image of an independent woman, a free woman, a woman who discussed politics, who was an intellectual, who had lovers, who had a sexual life not confined by bourgeois marriage and children, and who could use her brain to actually seduce with in some sense, that she was the incarnation for me as a 15-year-old of a woman who was independent, who was sexy, who could think, who was taken seriously as an intellectual, who was loved both because she was attractive and because she was a thinking woman. For me, that represented escape from Norway, from provincial
life.
Was
that before you learnt French?
Yes. I decided to learn French to become a professor of French because I read Simone de Beauvoir in Norwegian, basically.
And that's so funny because there was I in the south of South Australia in Adelaide. I in fact did it the other way around. I learnt French and then got on to Simone de Beauvoir when I was about 18. But she had a similarly dramatic impact on my life. I was looking around in Adelaide and my friends were busy getting engaged and getting married and having kitchen parties and moving with their young husbands to the suburbs and about to have babies. And I knew too that I didn't want that. Simone de Beauvoir was a way out, a most exciting way out.
I cannot let you get away sounding quite so optimistic and positive about Simone de Beauvoir. How about it, Toral? Is there a downside, in fact, to this woman and to the work that you have done about her? How about that?
Well, of course there is. I was talking about my perceptions when I was 15, and I'm no longer 15. what we have discovered, and this is, now I'm addressing the question of Beauvoir as an intellectual woman, as an image of the free intellectual woman. Mm-hmm. What we have discovered over the years, particularly with the publication of diaries and letters after her death, is of course that this life that I saw as a model image of freedom was not so perfect after all. And there are a few things that I want to mention here.
Fair enough.
First of all, the famous relationship with Jean-Paul Sartre, the philosopher. That was an open relationship. It's famous for two things. They had two pacts. The first pact was the pact of openness, that they were going to be free to have relations with other people. Although theirs was a necessary relationship, they were also to have contingent relationships, Sartre said famously. And the second point, the second pact was the pact of openness, which was they were going to tell each other everything. So there's the pact of freedom and the pact of openness. These two pacts sounded grand to me when I was 15.
Now, there's too much truth at work here. There's a brutality, finally. Am I right?
Well, there is brutality in it, and Beauvoir came to acknowledge it. First of all, there's brutality in engaging with other people. They have their necessary relationship. You engage with third persons on each side. They fall in love with you. You hurt them horribly when you tell them that, after all, my life is made with Sartre in Paris, as Simone de Beauvoir said to the American writer Nelson Algren. She said, I cannot give you more than 3 months a year. If you take that, that's fine. If not, go. And of course, they were deeply in love. They were both hurt. They suffered horribly. Then there's the question of relationships with, in Beauvoir's case, we have also discovered that she had relationships with other women. Mm-hmm. Often these women were her students or ex-students. Sometimes she shared them with Sartre. The two then become the dominant parent couple who just decide on what kind of emotions are appropriate for these young women. And it is a painful and nerve-wracking business for all of them.
Toral, let me stop you for a moment. You're leading us in the direction of the distinction, making the distinction between Simone de Beauvoir's life and the meaning of her life, what we make of it as readers and as students of culture. There are continuities, but there are also some great chasms at work here. Am I right?
Yes, I think you are right, Wayne. The way I would formulate it is that Simone de Beauvoir is very interesting in this respect. Her life, a picture of her life, has become a model and a role model for generations of intellectual women. What I have found out in my book, for instance, is that that is an idealized image. It's an image that has had real effect in my life, in Hazel's life.
But you don't live your life the way Simone lived her life.
No, I do not run millions of lovers and mistresses at the same time. I mean, although I dreamt about... Well, I may be lucky not to be able to do so, but I dreamt about that, of course, when I was 15, right. But I don't consider it an option when I'm a bit older. Uh-huh. The thing about Beauvoir is, therefore, that the image that of her ideal-free life is one that inspired a lot of women to change their lives in different ways, but always in the direction of freedom. That, and this brings me to the point, I think we really need role models when we're young, but I think it's lethal for us to stay stuck in the mode of idealizing a role model as a perfect image of success.
I take it, Hazel, that you did not and do not think of Christina Stead as a role model for your life. I mean, you draw on this life, and you make of it what you make of it in your biography, but how deeply personal was her life to you?
Well, I certainly admired her as a writer. I admired her capacity for intensely hard work, and I learnt a lot about writing from her, and in some ways about living. But I didn't ever identify with her as a strong woman, a model of independence, like I did in younger days. Identify with Simone de Beauvoir. But I think what's terrific about Toral's book is, apart from the fact that it's beautifully written and very accessible, is that she empathizes, would be a better word to use, with Simone de Beauvoir in a way which I personally found very appealing. I wasn't satisfied with Deirdre Baer's biography because I think that Deirdre Baer got too angry with Sartre and tried to knock him down. And also she wasn't sociological enough in her analysis of Simone de Beauvoir. Toral knows the French context extremely well. She's restored the sociological element in Beauvoir's education and culture. But above all, for me, it was a moving book because she both admires Beauvoir ardently and also understands her struggle and doesn't judge it.
Hazel, in your biography about Christina Stead, you use the term narrative. Let me turn to Toral Moy. Your book about Simone de Beauvoir is a biography, and yet it's not a biography. Tell me about how this word narrative enters into your project.
Well, the word narrative was really important to me because I really wanted to plot each chapter. I wanted the book to be readable. I really wanted to make my readers want to know how it turns out. Uh-huh. But it's not a story of someone's life. It's not a narrative in the biographical sense. I don't start with Beauvoir's birth and end up with her death. What I do is to try to focus on certain moments in her life and unravel the very complex network of voices that go into making that point.
A lot of choices to make here.
Yeah, I think my problem in the book is really to think about what is a person. I picture the person as a network of voices, as I just said. And then what I try to do in my book is to focus on the production, the making of Beauvoir as an intellectual woman. That means for me that I look at her education and I look at the reception of her work. I look at the way, the reason why the reception is important is that then I get to show how typically sexist cliches and stereotypes recur in the public presentation of an intellectual woman. What I show, for instance, is that she gets presented as a shrew, a harridan, a blue stocking, unsexy, and so on. Right. This happens from the 1940s to the 1990s without any change.
Toral, we love our stereotypes. We love to oversimplify. Somehow or other, that's just necessary to the way we talk about people.
This is true, but this is where Simone de Beauvoir is so important to me, because she shows how we have to lift ourselves out of these stereotypes if we're going to understand her at all. And so she helps us as intellectual women today to be able to lift ourselves out of these stereotypes. Simone de Beauvoir is therefore important to me for two reasons. I wanted to focus on her works because the reception of her work shows that she was not, or it's very hard for an intellectual woman to be taken seriously. So how could I write about her without taking her works incredibly seriously? That's why I have chapters, several chapters, discussing the second sex as a feminist text that speaks to feminism today. And that's not necessarily what a biographer does, for instance.
Hazel, let me turn to you and ask you to describe, what shall we call it here, the perils and rewards of the biographer's art. You have written a book that is more conventional as a biography than Toral's. What kinds of challenges did you face? Describe this for me.
Yes, mine is certainly a conventional biography. That doesn't make it conventional as a biography.
Mm-hmm.
I just find biography immensely exciting. I suppose the challenge is to write a good story, a bit like fiction, a story which weaves together and juxtaposes all sorts of interesting anecdotes and events. I found juxtaposition was one of the most interesting things, you know, the joy of plopping something beside something else.
Right.
But apart from wanting to tell stories about lives, I suppose that, like Toral, what I have in common is that I'm fascinated by what makes an individual what that person is. So biography is a wonderful excuse to sort of be a historian and be a psychologist and be a sociologist without actually being those things mm-hmm. terribly deeply. So that I wanted to portray what made Christina Stead psychologically, her childhood, and her times. So I look very deeply at history and politics.
Did you feel, let me ask you a sort of an idiosyncratic question here. Did you have conversations with Christina in your own mind? Did you talk to her in any sense and, as you said, psychologize her and try to figure out what she meant to you? How did that part of the process work?
Not so much that, but I must say that even though I said I didn't identify with her, which I was pleased about, I certainly became obsessed with her. And I do think that a biography is a very obsessive project.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually became quite resentful near the end that she didn't even leave me alone at night. You thought about things
right.
And everything seemed to be somehow relevant to Christina Stead's life. And it's a great cloud over your life that you're partly living somebody else's life.
Let's conclude our conversation, Hazel Rowley and Toral Moy. Let me turn to you, Hazel. Why do you want people to remember your subject, Christina Stead? Why is she important in the 1990s?
Because she's a great writer. She's Australian, but also extremely cosmopolitan. We talk a lot about postmodernism and how the postmodern subject doesn't absolutely have a nation anymore. You know, well, I think Christina Stead was in advance of her time, and that she's written about different cultures, different places, colonialism and post-colonialism, which interest us today, because she's funny, because she's angry, she's uncompromising, and I think she certainly has been neglected given the fact that she is a major 20th century writer.
Uh-huh. Toril, how about it? You think you spent a lot of time thinking about Simone de Beauvoir. How about your subject?
Well, I think that Simone de Beauvoir is really relevant to the 1990s for anybody who's interested in feminism and the question of the women's rights today. Where is feminism supposed to go in the 1990s? Simone de Beauvoir holds up a vision of a feminism that refuses to place requirements on women. And by that I mean a feminism that just says the aim of feminism is for women to be free. When women are free, we will see what they will do. There is no definition of woman in Simone de Beauvoir. Simone de Beauvoir doesn't tell us what women are supposed to be like. She says, let women be free and they will be what they can be.
Toril Moy teaches at Duke University, Hazel Rowley at Deakin University in Australia. Toril Moy is the author of Simone de Beauvoir, The Making of an Intellectual Woman, published by Blackwell. Hazel Rowley's biography of the Australian writer Christina Stead was published last year by Henry Holt. Stay tuned for information about writing for an audio cassette of this program. This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond with part four in a series of discussions for Women's History Month. My guests this week were Hazel Rowley of Deakin University and Toril Moy of Duke University. Audio tapes of this program are available postpaid for $10. Our address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 756. That's number 756. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Send us your comments and suggestions. Our email address is sounding, S-O-U-N-D-I-N-G, at uncecs.edu. Next week on Soundings, Shakespearean Scandals. Critic Stephen Greenblatt will be here with some new perspectives on the Bard of Avon. Support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.